I just finished reading Trust by Hernan Diaz. The plot of the book, without giving it all away, is about a financier who is wildly successful before the 1929 financial crisis. And then he adds to his wealth after the crash, and he credits his achievements to his ability to understand finance and his ability to do deep research. And the book is so good. And there are some really interesting twists that force the reader really to confront a number of perceptions that they might have about relationships and the stories that people tell about themselves. Okay, you might be saying, how is he possibly going to transition his reading of Trust with this week's guest? And stick with me, because I think the topic of research is what really prompted me to make the connection. Nathan Schilling is my guest this week, and he talks about something many school superintendents face. It's the number of researchers who want to study their school district. And for so many superintendents, researchers, they ask to study teaching and learning or student engagement, or often when they finish these studies, the district, they learn nothing of the researcher's findings. And so in this case, in our conversation, in this episode, the superintendent, Nathan Schilling, he actually describes how he reaches out to researchers, and he talks about how he engages the researcher community. And he describes superintendents as the lead learner, which, as you likely know, if you're a listener, that really warms my heart, because lead learners are an important part of this human-centered model that I talk so much about. In his after-action review, Nathan talks about the first days of the pandemic, to talk about confronting perceptions during a time of crisis. I'm Peter Stiepelman. This is An Imperfect Leader. Thanks for tuning in. Today on An Imperfect Leader, Dr. Nathan Schilling is my guest. Dr. Schilling is the superintendent of schools for Lansing School District 158 in South Cook County, Illinois, a position he has held since 2018. Nathan has experience at every level of public education, and he's been a high school principal as well as a middle school band and general music teacher, which, by the way, there's a special place in heaven for all kindergarten teachers and anyone who's done anything at middle school. Additionally, he is a continuing adjunct professor of educational leadership at Concordia University Chicago. Dr. Schilling has been recognized for his many leadership accomplishments. Many of them were recently highlighted by the National Association of School Superintendents. And I should note that I will make a link available to in the show notes. Finally, Nathan holds a black belt in Japanese martial art, Aikido. That's super cool. I was super excited to find that. So Dr. Schilling, welcome to An Imperfect Leader.
Thank you, Peter. Happy to be here.
You know, I would note that you don't sound that excited. You could be a little bit more excited. I saw how much coffee you were drinking before our conversation.
Well, I'm quite excited, believe me.
That's okay. Nathan, I recently read an article that you wrote titled, I've Benefited from Engaging with Educational Researchers. And the piece really spoke of the relationship between schools and higher education researchers. And I wanted to talk to you a bit about that, because my experience as a superintendent in a university town was that we were like inundated with research requests. And really what puzzled me most was how often we wouldn't learn what the researchers had actually discovered. I mean, like no recommendations on how to adjust practice or how to improve processes. But when I read your piece, I was envious of how your partnerships really yielded better outcomes. And it was really clear that you learned a good deal about human resources practices, succession planning, hiring, and internal staff movement. And I mean, these are really areas that district leaders in any field truly want to do better. So I guess my first question would be, would you talk a little bit about how you engage researchers and really the process that you followed?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for asking that question. It's something I'm very passionate about, is connecting the K-12 community to higher education. As you mentioned previously, I've been an adjunct professor in the Department of Educational Leadership at Concordia University Chicago for 10 years now. And I have a close connection with a lot of the work being done at that university. And as an extension of that, some of the professional research associations that the professors there are involved in. Things like the American Educational Studies Association, the Midwest Educational Research Association, and the American Educational Research Association, or AERA. That's kind of the big one. So that's where I've done a number of publications. I've kind of shared how we can collaborate better between those two levels. But you're not wrong. A lot of times, K-12 learning organizations function in autonomy, kind of away from the work being done in higher ed, and it doesn't really filter down to what we're doing, and vice versa. Unless you're talking about something like student teaching, where there are active students and learners who are coming in to do clinical experiences in the K-12 environment. So there's a saying, building leaders should be the lead learners of their school buildings. And I've often said, and I've kind of written a bit to this and presented to this, that the superintendent should be the lead learner of the school district. So it really is kind of our responsibility as the CEO, as the person who's kind of representing the organization, to make those connections. And so I've been a member of AERA now for, I think, maybe 5 years. I've been a member of Division A, which is kind of the educational administration division. And I've also been a program chair for research on the superintendency, which is one of their special interest groups. And so they very much cater to sitting superintendents to engage with the researcher community. I became involved in that because I published my dissertation, which I did my PhD at Concordia also, through some of their publications presented at the conference. I kind of made some connections that way and then just started becoming more interested in what they do. But I would encourage any aspiring or sitting superintendent to really look into those specific higher ed research-based organizations that cater to superintendents. There's a whole special interest group for ARA devoted to superintendents. And I don't think there's enough sitting superintendents that are involved in that sort of thing. And so I've done some publications and talked about how we can be more involved in their research, be more involved in their presentations, and vice versa. But I think the first step is a superintendent needs to sit back and say, if we're the lead learner, we need to learn that research. We need to make those extensions. We need to communicate. We need to reach out. We need to invite them into our space as well. So I like collaborating with professors. We did a school board conference presentation last November, November of 22, and I had a professor from the University of Findlay in Ohio as part of that session. I've involved Concordia faculty, and they share research. They share current best practice. And it was interesting because that portion of the presentation was the one that was the most in demand from the audience after we were done. Everybody came up to her and asked, "How can I get a copy of this literature review? How can I get a copy of these studies? Because these are the things that I can take back to my own school district, to my own school board." It was about facilities. It was about the benefit of renovating and expanding facilities for equity for the sake of students. And so other school districts wanted this because they wanted to be able to go back to their local school boards and say, "Hey, look, the research said this is great. Lansing's done it. We want to be able to do this too."
So let me see if I understand correctly, because what it really appears is that in the situation I described, we were sort of the passive recipients of research in the sense that researchers approached us and said, we want to do research on mathematics at elementary with second language learners, or we want to better understand the use of technology in middle school art classes. You know, it was all these researchers coming to us and saying, we just want to use you as our laboratory. And what you're suggesting is that if you're going to serve as a lead learner, that you should really engage researchers who are out there because they are craving to do work and they'd love to do work that's going to be meaningful to you. And so in your case, you were interested to know how are our facilities being used, or what should we be thinking about, or if we're going to renovate versus rebuild or versus demolish, that there's probably a way to look at this from a research lens that could really benefit our community and other communities like ours.
Yeah, correct. So in higher education, they love to disseminate their research. There are some universities that, as part of their doctoral program, there is a class solely devoted to disseminating research. So they want their research to get out there, to be published, to get presented, to be shared, and to make an impactful difference in the field. So I guess the question, the obvious question that I would ask is, whether it was you, whether it's another sitting superintendent, somebody from higher ed comes to you, a professor, a researcher, whoever, and says, I want to do a study in your school district. Is there that natural follow-up for the superintendent to say, when you're finished, can I have a copy of your study? You know, that doesn't always happen. You know, sometimes it's kind of a they'll take it and they'll disseminate it amongst their peers and among their networks, but we don't kind of extend that olive branch to say, hey, we want this to come back. Or even better, would you come back and share your findings with my administrative team, with my school district, but I mean, depending on what the appropriate audience is and what the study is. So I think we, as instructional leaders, we can do more to advocate for bringing those resources in. And that's ultimately one of the most important jobs of a superintendent, is to bring in quality resources that support the work of your school district. We did a strategic plan 5 years ago, and the facilitator's name was Dr. Bob Madonia. He's a retired superintendent from here in Illinois, Frankfort community. And he had a saying. His saying was always, "You can't be a prophet in your own land." So, to that extent, too, I mean, involving higher ed researchers, people that have a proven body of work in the field, adds credibility to whatever data you're trying to collect. So, if I'm looking for something to get shared with my school board, the local regional office of education, the state board of education, it's great coming from me, but it's even better coming from an objective third party who did this through a vetted, peer-reviewed research process.
In the leadership model that I use to advise others, there's a dimension, nested patterns. And that's really the muscle of an organization's work. And inside that dimension are the terms high-level collaboration and shared leadership. And when I was preparing for our conversation, I read a piece of advice that you had for leaders. And you said it was one of your earliest lessons as you were transitioning from the principalship of a small rural high school to the superintendency of a larger district with a lot of moving parts. I think you even referenced the phrase, "It takes a village." Would you speak to that? What was the event or what was the moment that you learned about the role of collaboration as a district leader?
So the journey you described, Peter, is exactly correct. So I was the principal of a small rural high school in Beecher, Illinois, with at most 375 kids. I had a dean of students, I had a guidance counselor, and I had an assistant dean, which is a position I kind of created out of a teaching position that just provided a little bit of additional support. I was very used to doing a lot of things on my own. For example, I did all of the certified staff evaluations myself every single year. I was able to walk around the entire building every passing period. I was out in the parking lots, I was out in the fields. And so my world, so to speak, the fishbowl was only so big. Then you go from that to a school district that has five schools. Every single one of them, except our primary center, is bigger than that one high school. And now you have 2,700 kids over a much larger area that's a little bit more urban and suburban. And so what I found out very quickly was the old approach to leadership kind of centered on me and my ability to, kind of handle things myself, whether it's communication, whether it's visibility, whether it's evaluations. There was a strong need very quickly to understand that you cannot do everything yourself. That as a superintendent, you need to know best practices in delegation and in collaboration. And I always liken this to a depth chart in football. A good football team doesn't just have good starting players. They have solid second string players who can sub in when necessary. They have solid third string players. And the more depth and quality you have on the bench, the better the football team is. And the more it can last and deal with crisis when something happens to one of those starting players. And so I've always been of a mindset that you create that kind of depth within an organization. I'm a big fan of systematic change. And so I inherited a lot of great administrators when I came here to Lansing. What I didn't do was understand initially the best practices and how to most utilize them effectively and have them almost be like an extension of me and of the superintendent's office. And so I started working very quickly to try to empower people, to trust people. And trust is an interesting thing because I built it up in 6 years in Beecher with the people that I worked with. Came in brand new here externally. I wasn't like the previous superintendent who over 20 something years, she rose from a paraprofessional to a teacher to an assistant principal to a principal to, I mean, she worked her all the way up. And so you build decades of institutional trust by doing that. Me, I came in brand new. So you have to kind of forge those relationships very quickly and start learning, how to trust, how to empower. And so that was something that I had to work on right away as a new leader.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, because your predecessor, they knew her heart. And so as she assumed the superintendency, and that was likely she had so much banked in terms of emotional, goodwill. And so for someone who's new, who's coming in, and they're all wary of the new person, I'm curious, you inherited all this great talent. What might have been one strategy that you used to harvest the wisdom of these individuals so that you were making decisions together, even though, you know, you're setting a direction, but you're doing this work together.
So the district had a good framework for administrative team meetings, for the collective administrative team to get together and discuss initiatives and come up with problem solving for various things going on in the district. What it didn't do was have a clearly defined cabinet, so to speak. It had departmentalized administrators, director, business managers, that sort of thing, but they very much worked in isolation. And so and we had a very strong superintendent at the top who rose, you know, up through the ranks over a couple decades, had a great school board, that hired me. But those departments kind of functioned on their own, like islands. And I would say that the immediate thing that I did was establish what I call the executive leadership team, the ELT, which is essentially the superintendent's cabinet, and started having ELT meetings on an ongoing basis. And I brought the business office and the curriculum office and the special ed office together to actually hear from each other and collaborate and forge relationships, not just with me, but with each other.
Right. As a way to avoid working across purposes or to know what is a big priority for a department in that year so that the business office can support that by when they're proposing or you're proposing a budget, that they know that they're allocating that and that is not working at, you know, at odds with other departments. Yeah, that's really smart. That's really smart.
And I'll add to that, too. Towards the end of my second year, we hired a human resources director, which was an amazing resource to have during the COVID-19 pandemic. The districts that didn't have one to handle all the contact tracing, the vaccination records, all that things, had a much more difficult time with all of that. And so now you've got someone for personnel, someone for money, someone for facilities, someone for educational services for gen ed, someone for educational services for special ed. And you combined all these different component parts. And what really happened was they not only developed trust and started working better in collaboration with me, but also with each other. And so that just advanced the entire district office.
Nathan, what does the term an imperfect leader mean to you? How does that resonate for you?
So I am a recent graduate of the Illinois Association of School Administrators School for Advanced Leadership. As part of that program, the thing they emphasized for us from the very first session, very first one, was you're not just a leader, you're a human being. And human beings are imperfect. Human beings make mistakes. Human beings need to develop and learn from mistakes. And that was something that we were encouraged to do. If you look at some of the very best leading companies in the world, there's research that shows that creating a safe space within which to take risks and make mistakes fosters innovation and advances organizations. And that is like CEO language 101, creating those spaces. And that's best practice in teaching. You want to have classrooms where kids are comfortable making mistakes. When I was a band director, and I do appreciate your props to my middle school band teaching, I used to tell my students, make your mistakes here in rehearsal. Go ahead, make them. So you don't make them on stage when we perform in front of the community. And so I think that there's a really strong emphasis as part of at least how we are trained as superintendents in Illinois to acknowledge the human element of being a superintendent, not just the face of the district who's the administrator, the leader, the CEO, that there is a human being behind that. And that should always be remembered in the way that you approach the role.
And we'll be right back. Hey, district leaders, I know you already know this. In schools worldwide, cell phones are posing real challenges on student engagement and mental well-being. And I want you to meet Yonder, a proud sponsor of an imperfect leader. And let me share this story from a visit I made to some schools in Silicon Valley. I asked some kids what they liked about Yonder, and after some funny looks, they shared that actually, with Yonder, teachers don't have to battle with them over phones anymore. In fact, one kid said to me he didn't have to worry anymore about his parents texting him in class, and the kid next to him like sort of shoved him and goes, "Texting? My mom used to FaceTime me in class." I want to introduce you to a support system that increases teaching and learning. I want you to discover why a million students choose Yonder daily. Minimize distractions. Maximize learning potential. To learn more, go to overyonder.com. Y-O-N-D-R. We're back for segment two of an imperfect leader called Imperfect Leadership in After Action. And my guest is Dr. Nathan Schilling, Superintendent of Schools for Lansing School District 158 in South Cook County, Illinois. And in this segment, we ask our guests to deconstruct a decision that they have made, and then we discuss it. But before we go into that section, I want to address the fact that, yes, Dr. Schilling was a band teacher. And my story as a superintendent going to a middle school band class was I remember watching the band, practice, and then the band director saying, "Would you like to say something to the band?" And I said, "Oh, that'd be great." And I launched into this whole thing about, band for me was a sanctuary, it was a safe place, it was such an amazing place, and I met the most amazing people, and I continue to play music to this day, and boy, I'm so glad that you're in band. And it was just silence, and then one kid goes like this. I got slow clapped by a middle school kid. He says, "Well, thanks for coming." And I said, "Well, thanks for your sincerity." So, middle school, special place in heaven. Oh, yeah. Okay, what happened?
So I'm going to start by saying you just circled back to your initial point about teaching middle school kids. That is a very typical reaction. And I've said similar things myself to the band over at Memorial Junior High School. Okay, so I think, like, if you were to ask that question, tell us about a situation where you made some decisions that maybe were not the best in the moment, from which you, though, still learned and moved yourself and your organization forward. I think you'd get some very, very, very interesting answers if you asked any superintendent who led their district through the COVID-19 pandemic. And I am no exception. So I've been in Lansing for 6 years now. And I remember very clearly I was in year two of my superintendency, sitting in this seat March 13th of 2020, which was a Friday the 13th, when Governor J.B. Pritzker got on the news. And I was sitting in my office, and on my Promethean board, I had projected the news and his address. And one of our elementary principals was in there with me and my assistant. And we watched him say that the entire state was going on shutdown, on quarantine for 2 weeks. And we were a district that did not have e-learning. We were a district that had not, prior to that, yet planned for a way to have kids go home with computers and engage in virtual learning when they were not able to be in school in person. In fact, we didn't even have enough one-to-one devices to say every kid could get assigned a computer and go home and participate in e-learning. So we really had two choices to make very quickly. One was to try to establish some kind of remote learning plan, which would engage the kids in some kind of learning activity while they were at home, but not necessarily use computers and do virtual learning. And the other was trying to scramble quickly and get some kind of an e-learning plan in place. Some districts took one route, some districts took the other. We chose to get all of our staff together at our junior high school that following Monday, take an emergency institute day and plan 13 weeks of home learning activities. That would be choice boards, packets, things that kids could access electronically, but didn't need a computer because we had hard copies available at all of our schools. You could come get them. And that was how we chose to approach what the governor said was going to be 2 weeks. But in retrospect, I had told my employees, plan 13 weeks. Plan just in case this thing continues. And we kind of stuck to our guns. We stuck to our guns for 13 weeks and did home learning activities because that 2 weeks turned into a month. That month turned into 2 months, and I'm sure everybody knows the story of what happened after that. It was the whole, I mean, it's history, It's in a profession who said they're going to be writing about this 100 years from now, about the pandemic of 2020.
Sure. Well, I hope they look back and learn as compared to where we were, where we looked back and said, okay, so what happened in 1918 with the Spanish flu? What did we learn from that? Because there were some best practices that certainly were practiced by a number of communities, and that's a whole nother conversation. And I really do appreciate that you're sort of slicing one piece of this pandemic. And I have not yet talked to a superintendent on the podcast who has actually wanted to talk mostly about the beginning, right? We've talked about e-learning, and providing devices in the new school year, or what did hybrid learning look like, or the mask debate, or all those types of things. But slicing this into those initial weeks and the actions taken and the lessons learned, I think is really a juicy topic. And so let me ask you, what do you see as you're looking back right now and as you've had these conversations, what got overlooked?
So initially, I think it was the importance of directly engaging kids, the importance of actually, and if you can't be face to face, which we know is the best for students. We learned this from COVID-19, and there's a wealth of information to support this. But it was in some classes, the kids only did the home learning activities. And we did not mandate the teachers do any kind of virtual instruction. We did give laptop computers to all of our teachers and paraprofessionals, and we created spaces in which they could, of their own initiative, kind of go beyond the home learning activities and engage classes on Zoom, or engage classes on, we're a Microsoft district, so we have Microsoft Teams. You know, so I think by not having that level of consistency, and that was, the consistency was in the home learning activities. You know, our goal was to preserve students at the level they were, not necessarily introduce a ton of new content and advance the curriculum, but to at least try to prevent learning loss. I think maybe we could have done a little bit of a better job trying to create more consistency in this type of an engagement and actually having some level of direct synchronous teaching in addition to the asynchronous activities.
What might that have looked like? And I ask that because similar to what you describe, I was a larger district in Missouri, and we were running Kinko's packets so that every grade level at elementary would have some work to do at home. So I'm kind of curious, when you're saying that what got overlooked was consistency, it sounds like because there was sort of a patchwork of approaches being done by teachers in different schools and in different grades and different classrooms, that lack of consistency may have led to some confusion, frustration among your constituents in terms of your families. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Yeah, you could say that. You could also say that it created some inconsistencies in students' learning level. So when you look at learning loss, I mean, I couldn't look at my third grade class of students across the district and say they were all in the same place, because some of them may have just gotten home learning activities. Some of them may have gotten home learning activities and some level of direct virtual teaching. There are like various levels of engagement. But again, everybody's home circumstances were different too.
Right. You know,
we had people go home and some maybe had the aptitude to do that. Some maybe had the ability based on their family circumstances, based on their home internet infrastructure, based on their computer proficiency. And there had been no professional development. Keep in mind that it's not like when we started the following school year, we trained everybody on Microsoft Teams. We made available all of the modules from Microsoft itself. So there were virtual components, there were in-person components. Our technology director was running sessions. You know, so then you can create more consistency because everybody's gotten the same education.
When you think about it, though, as a leader, your primary job is to keep kids safe, and your primary job is to consider the basic needs of a child. And so I imagine when you're talking about that word maintain, so educationally, you were hoping to maintain where they were so that children wouldn't backslide and they'd be able to move forward when you were able to come back together. Also, the word maintain in terms of making sure that children had access to food and they had access to mental health and they had access to some degree, technology. They had access to medication or, you know, so you're partnering with your United Ways and you're partnering with other mental health coalitions and things like that. And so, you know, when you have to put hand to hand, you know, which one you're going to focus on, it seems to me where you put your priority was really in maintaining the basic needs of your kids.
I would agree with that. But I will share this. There is something very powerful that came out of this. And I would say that is the power and value of charitable acts and donations.
So let's get to that, because I want to ask you, what did you learn about relationships or what new relationships were formed? And that really seems to speak to this idea of relationships between the school system and the system at large. So talk about that.
So let's talk about elevating families and elevating a community in addition to not just supporting kids. So had we had one-to-one technology, we would have had computers sent home with kids, we would have engaged kids in some level of e-learning. What we did instead, and I give a lot of credit to our administrative team, our school board, this is a very much a collaborative effort, but instead of sending kids home with computers, we actually scoured all of our storage rooms and every area in the district that had old computing devices. And we donated them all to families. So I think when all was said and done, we must have donated over 2,300 individual refurbished laptop computers. And keep in mind, I have 2,700 students.
Right.
So that's like almost saying every family potentially got a computing device. But these were computers that weren't being used otherwise. and they were refurbished. They were cleared. Our attorney helped us create a form that allowed us to donate these. And basically, at no cost to the district, the board took many actions to donate refurbished machines.
Yeah, and I do want to point that out, because for a superintendent who's listening, who's thinking, oh, can I donate? There is a process to surplus your publicly purchased materials and devices. So, you know, there is an opportunity to do that. I would encourage you to talk to your council, your bond council, if you bought things with bond money, which you probably shouldn't buy technology with your bond money, but some districts have. So talk to your attorneys about that. There is a way to surplus so that it is essentially a donation to your community. But sorry to interrupt, Nathan, but I certainly want to make sure that there's a distinction there. You can't just donate. There's a process to do that.
No, and that's an excellent point. So we took action through our board on a couple different occasions that added up to all these machines. But basically, the idea was to take a machine that didn't have all of the monitoring software, all of the locks on it, all of the virus protection on all of the things we have on our machines to protect kids. We essentially just gave clean, unlocked computers, almost as though you'd just buy a used computer, brand new, for a family, and we gave these to our families. And so what happened was we found that this was able to actually elevate families and in some respects elevate the community, because now you had homes, family homes that maybe did not have a family computer. Now they have one. Now you can do job applications. Maybe those parents needed help working remotely. You know, there were certain things, and we're a predominantly low-income community. We are a very diverse community. And so we were actually able to support whole families in a way that we maybe didn't anticipate had we had an e-learning plan in place. So I think from a collaborative standpoint, from a community, a partnership standpoint, this was a very powerful thing that came out of this. And it was a win-win, because we now don't have storage rooms upon storage rooms of old devices just sitting there. And every single school was allocated machines and they all got donated out.
You mentioned job interviews, being able to work from home potentially now that there were devices. I imagine telehealth became something that was now an opportunity for families that potentially was not possible beforehand. What frustrated you?
I think a lot of the state mandates that kind of came down that were very uncompromising. Now, we were a district that put safety above everything else. And so everything that came down from the governor's office, that came from the state, we fully actualized for the sake of safety. But, you know, there was a significant loss of local control during the pandemic. And, you know, we don't fault the state for that. You know, we trusted and supported the governor in every action. And, you know, sometimes that led to some conflict with members of our community. Sometimes that led to conflict with members of our school board. Sometimes that led to certain, you know, there a lot of districts dealt with political fallout from the pandemic. I would not say that we were by any means one of the worst, but every once in a while you'd get a new executive order and then all of a sudden something had changed and now we were scrambling to try to accommodate this piece or this piece. And I think we did a good job putting the right components in place, but I know towards the end, you know, there were parents very frustrated that kids were still wearing masks. And I remember having many conversations with parents about, you know, the reason for this, the executive order from the governor. But sometimes, you know, people just get frustrated with, why can't you and your school board make that decision for us and for our community? And so you found a little bit of a disconnect, you know, in the local versus state control of some of this. But I think for the most part, we did a pretty good job navigating that.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's a thought within the community, we locally elect this board to make decisions with you as a superintendent, and you're telling me that they don't have that right. From state to state, there were different perspectives, certainly, and different ways that they had to interact based on who their executive branch was. And so, you know, in some countries, it was an executive order for the whole country. Maybe to some extent, we were pleased that states were given the authority to make some decisions. And then within each state, we all had different ways of approaching or sort of interacting with those orders.
So a large portion of my staff lives in Northwest Indiana. We at Lansing, Illinois, is right on the border of Indiana. And so actually, that's an interesting point you make about federal versus state control, because there's that juxtaposition too. We dealt with a lot of situations where we were fully remote in Illinois. We were fully virtual. Indiana was fully open, you know. So you had issues with where do my kids go here versus my kids are in school here, and people feeling divided between their obligations in their personal lives and their professional lives. And we had board members that would get very frustrated. And some of them wanted our schools open more quickly. And they'd look and see, like, well, so-and-so's kids are back in school already. And so that created some discourse as well. Again, not anything I don't think we didn't navigate well, but being right on the border, it was something we experienced firsthand.
That is fascinating. In the end, what was something that was good that came out of this experience for you?
Well, before I answer that, I'll speak a little bit, kind of looking back. Andy Stanley is kind of a well-known preacher, and he will often say that in life we have rearview mirrors. We can't go in reverse. So it's important to be reflective, but it's also important to acknowledge the past is the past. We made the mistakes we did. We need to learn from them. We need to move forward. And I guess that's kind of a good segue then to your question. I do feel like we elevated our entire school district as a result of that experience. Because now, fast forward, a couple years out of the COVID-19 pandemic, we have one-to-one technology for all of our kids. We have more staff technology available. We have more online learning programs than we've ever had before, and better use and training of those programs. We have more online curriculum materials. We've done a number of new curriculum adoptions since that all happened. We have a legit multi-year e-learning plan. In Illinois, they go for 3 years. And we have the capacity now from this office, from the superintendent's office, that if there is something of danger to our school district, and I'm sure your listeners will sympathize with how many school districts have dealt with shooting threats, how many have dealt with crisis situations. We had a situation, and I tell this to my district, and my crisis committee chair, who's one of my principals, says this all the time as well. We don't have to call e-learning just because of weather. I mean, if the roads are bad, if the snow is bad, e-learning is a tool we have, absolutely. But if somebody makes a legitimate shooting threat to our school district, and I don't feel like it's safe to have in-person school, I can call an e-learning day. And I think that is a very powerful tool to have in today's climate of school safety.
My guest again today was Dr. Nathan Schilling, the superintendent of schools for Lansing School District 158 in South Cook County, Illinois. And Nathan, this podcast was developed exclusively to help leaders recognize that they weren't alone, that we have each other, that in your words and of the words of others, that it takes a village. And every village used to have something called a town crier, and that person would let you know that all was well. And really, you've let us know that all can be well when we engage the talent in our communities to get better, and that we take the experiences like the pandemic and we make decisions that will impact us and have a ripple effect for a better life for our kids, and to your point, for our entire community. Thank you so much for spending time with me.
You're very welcome, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Music for An Imperfect Leader was written and arranged by Ian Varley. Sam Falbo created our artwork, a wood print inspired Daruma doll butterfly. Remember, imperfect leadership is not a scarlet letter. It's a badge of honor. It recognizes that serving as a lead learner is about being a vulnerable leader, an empathetic leader, a compassionate leader. And I'm proud to be an imperfect leader. I'm Peter Stiepelman. Please join me next time for another episode of An Imperfect Leader, Leadership in After Action.